The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is February 1st, 2011. Members in the audience, today we're going to have a little review of our data practices laws, rules, how we approach them. It's a subject matter that I particularly enjoy. Most people don't. We used to have a subdivision of this committee. We don't have it this year because I wanted to make sure that all of the members got the enjoyment of studying data practices rather than just a subdivision to the committee. But nevertheless, we're going to have a discussion of where are we now, how did we get here, and what are some of the threats to privacy of our citizens, as well as the access to government records that many of us believe that should be as open as possible for the public to determine what the government is doing, not only for them, but to them. So we'll be starting out with Lori Beyer-Kropensky for opening comments. And then we'll be followed by Don Gemberling, Richard Neumeister, and Mark Anfinson. Anytime you wish to start, Ms. Beyer-Kropensky.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Beyer-Kropensky, and it's great to see a few familiar faces as well as some new ones as well. I direct the Information Policy Analysis Division of the Department of Administration. It's known as IPAD for short, and Senator Limmer will verify that it was iPad
Thank
before
you.
Apple ever had iPad. And I'm going to give you just a brief overview of the Data Practices Act, and really feel free to ask questions as they come up. Now, with all the huge issues that are facing the state, health care, education, funding for the courts, just the budget in general, it doesn't matter if you're new or if you've been around a really long time, you're probably wondering why in the world should you care about data practices? How does it impact you? Why should you save any part of your brain for learning this? Does it impact your constituents, each and every one of them, and everyone else in the state? And by the time I'm done, hopefully, you'll all want to learn more about this, just like Senator Limmer, and you will be able to spot data issues on any of the committees that you serve on. Now, my office provides data practices and open meeting law technical assistance to over 12,000 people each year, and you have a handout that more detailed explains what my office does. Our customers are really diverse. They include citizens, the media, so Mr. Anfinson's clients, state and local government, anyone who needs help, including legislators and your staff. We also provide training, informational resources. We have a great website, and we assist the Commissioner of Administration with statutory responsibilities, including issuing advisory opinions, which is one of the mechanisms you have passed to ensure compliance and enforcement with data practices. The part that's probably going to be the most important for you to know is that we provide legislative drafting assistance and subject matter expertise. Our role is unusual for a state agency because we will frequently testify about the impact of a particular bill. Will it work with an existing state and federal law? Does it do what the author wants it to within state and federal law? And are there any unintended consequences? Then also, from our work with customers and in issuing advisory opinions, we will also have initiatives of our own where we're trying to promote technical and policy changes to make data practices easier to understand, clearer, and better able to be implemented by everyone who has to use it, so both the government and citizens. So I'm going to start off with a question, and because we never get to question all of you. So what do all these things have in common? Expungement of criminal records, marketing letters from massage therapists, chiropractors, and attorneys after a car crash, opposition research, Tubby Smith's basketball camp income, gang and criminal intelligence databases, and lastly, for me, the huge challenge of mailing party invitations to your child's public school classmates. Anyone have any guesses what they all have in common?
Someone's personal information.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz. That's one thing they all have in common. And also, many of these issues, they've been in the media in the last several years, and getting this data or not being able to get this data is all made possible or impossible by Minnesota's Government Data Practices Act. So, and oftentimes, Senator Limmer highlighted this, data practices has a pretty challenging reputation. It makes often people run screaming from the room, and I'm pretty sure that I've seen some of you run from the room when the topic comes up. But it is certainly complex. It can be frustrating, exciting, very emotional, depending on the issues, and very interesting. Kind of like buying a house, falling in love, all those same things, emotional, frustrating, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. There are some key features about this law that make it unique, and I want you to walk away with just knowing enough to be able to spot issues on the committees that you serve on, and also give you a structure for how do you weigh the different policy debates that you are going to be faced with, and how do you weigh the arguments of the advocates that are going to be coming before you, and some of whom you're going to hear from today. I think the most important thing for you to know about data practices is that it doesn't apply to the legislature. So you're all good. It also doesn't apply to the courts. The courts and the legislature have their own rules of access. So who it does apply to is government entities in Minnesota. So state agencies, public schools, charter schools, cities, counties, watershed districts. So that's who it applies to. And government data is everything that's in some kind of recorded format. Your old-fashioned paper files, your flash drive, your DVDs, your emails, videos, anything that's recorded. So if I write notes during this hearing, it's government data. If I send an email to my boss from my Hotmail account about work, that's government data too, something in recorded format. And one of the things that makes Minnesota unique and special, besides the Mall of America, which I love, is our presumption that all data is public, everything. Everything is public unless it's not. And the goal of the law is to promote government accountability and transparency, and also to protect privacy for individuals. And protecting privacy for people who either voluntarily or are forced to give government data is one of the things that distinguishes our law from the Federal Freedom of Information Act. The FOIA is more about public access and isn't really a vehicle for protecting privacy of individuals. This law was passed in the 1970s, after Watergate, when people were really worried about what government had and what were we keeping on people. You know, what was J. Edgar Hoover following about John Lennon? People wanted to be able to prevent government from having secret files, secret databases, making secret arrests. So if you followed any of last session's debate around or media coverage on gang databases, you'll have realized that many people are still just as worried as after Watergate about what government has, who can see it, how it's going to be used, and how it's, you know, impacting people. Some of the examples of public data in Minnesota: adult arrest records, salaries for government employees, minutes from a city council meeting, liquor licenses, property records, travel expenses for government employees. So it really ranges the gamut. Now, I already told you our presumption is everything's public, but you also, the legislature, has had a number of areas where you have just taken that presumption and reversed it. In areas like school records, data about welfare clients, employee records, driver's license data. So there are a couple areas where everything is just tipped on its head, but for the most part, we wind up with a lot of public data in Minnesota. And anyone can do anything they want with public data. So that's how you get opposition research by candidates, baby formula marketing, mailing those party invitations to the whole first grade, booking photos being on the front page of the paper. It's someone using public data for their own purpose, and there's nothing wrong with that. One of the reasons the law is in there is transparency and accountability. And the reason everyone keeps coming to the legislature year after year is that you have reserved the power to classify data. So you get to decide if data is going to be protected as not public, and then when and why is it going to get shared. So you have that decision-making power. So when you decide what to protect and who it's going to be shared with, I want you to remember this balancing test. And if you look at your colorful handout in the top right-hand corner, there's these little kind of scales. One piece of this balancing test is the government needs data to do its work. Public has a right to know, and there are also individual privacy rights. And in Minnesota, often we treat businesses different than we do treat individual human beings. So sometimes the data practices debate will really center on why is government collecting certain data and how long they need to keep it. Data practices limits government to collecting only what they need to do their work. But often, government programs like your county sheriff, they've got large missions that require collections of lots of data. And if government has data, the next question is going to be, should it be public? Or should people who are giving it to the government be entitled to some privacy? So those are always the questions we're faced with. We've got two related laws, the Official Records Act and the Records Management Statute. Official Records Act requires government to document their official actions. And there is always policy debate on how much or how little government keeps to document their activities. If you've been following Mr. Neumeister's blog, you'll have read his call to Governor Dayton to retain more data, such as emails, so that citizens can request them. The Records Management Statute then sets a minimum for how long certain records are going to be kept, but doesn't require them to be destroyed. So often the policy debate is requiring government to dispose of certain records, requiring them to collect only certain limited data sets, and also the consequences when government then keeps data longer than some others. An example of this would be in a statute that the legislature passed to allow permits to carry in Minnesota. There is a very detailed list of only certain data elements that can be collected from people. So the legislature has decided, you know what, we're not going to leave it up to government. We're going to tell you, you can only collect this much. So that's often a data practices debate that you will see. One thing that makes data practices complex is that there are some federal laws. And, Mr. Chair, you and I have talked about those federal laws. They can impact your ability in the state to pass policy, and sometimes they even trump state law. So oftentimes we're trying to say, you can pass that, but it's not going to be, it can't be implemented. And some of the big laws are HIPAA in the healthcare arena, FERPA for educational records, and our perennial favorite, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which protects a lot of driver's license records from probably about three people and lets everyone else have them.
Yeah.
So the three things for you to remember: our presumption is data is always public. The legislature decides what's going to get protected and who it gets shared with. And then in making those decisions, you're weighing the three-legged stool of government need for the data, privacy, the public's right to know. So as you are crafting bills or you're hearing about them in committees or on the Senate floor, think about how the bill's going to work. Will it require government to collect something new that they haven't collected before? If it's going to, do you want that data to be public or protected? And should that data even be protected from the people it's about? So imagine a criminal investigation. Even though it's about me, I'm not going to have access to it. So you just kind of think, if you don't mind the data being public, you don't have anything else to do. But if you think, this is going to require government to collect some stuff, and I think there should be some protections, then you know where to go to get some help. So we've got some food for thought. I'm going to read off some examples. It's not a test. But some of the data are public and some aren't. And these are policy decisions that previous legislatures have faced. And in hearing them, try to think of the balancing test and see how you think they ought to be classified. You don't have to have the right answer. But really, just what's your gut reaction? Protect, not protect. Government employee salaries. No one's going to weigh in. Okay. That's public. Many people are used to that. A draft of a city budget. It's public. Most people are surprised by that. Social Security numbers. Everyone uniformly is like, okay, yeah, that shouldn't be public. Public school special ed students IEP.
Private.
Does that hit you differently than how much I make? Probably, so that is private data. The name and address of adults arrested by local law enforcement. So DWIs.
Public.
Public. Welfare recipients.
Private.
So I get food stamps. Should I be entitled to protection? Yes, there's protection in law for that. But the name of a citizen who complains about police brutality. What do you think? I'm looking at our law enforcement members. Mm-hmm. Do you think that should be the name of someone who complains about police brutality? Do you think it should be public or private?
Private.
It's public. And some folks think that that has a chilling effect on people wanting to complain about law enforcement. The names and addresses of criminal sexual assault victims. What? Not public. The names and addresses of other crime victims. Burglary. Robbery. They're public generally. So we treat different kinds of crime victims differently. So the name of someone who licenses their dog in St. Paul. Public. But there has been certainly concerns about people about should people be able to know what kind of dog I have and where I live. And that'll be the kind of policy debates that you will probably have to have. Now, state agency legislative proposals. Now, this is how you think they should be classified, not how you want them to be classified. Not public. You're right, Senator Limmer.
Really?
Correspondence with an elected official. This is one of those weird ones. It depends, either person. So if Senator Limmer sends me an email, I can decide if it's going to be public or not. And if, say, he was the mayor, he could decide if he wanted his correspondence to be public or not. So it's one of those very strange ones that you've passed that lets the sender and the receiver decide how they want to treat it.
Ms. Beyer-Kerpensky?
Yes.
What policy does a private citizen have with a letter that comes from one of us?
None. Senator Limmer, anything that you send to someone, just like if you send it to me or to a private citizen, they can decide if they want to, you know, how they want to share it, how they want to use it, and really no expectation of privacy around the things that we send to people.
I'm just mentioning that to our freshman senators, that if you put anything in writing, just assume that it will be in the headlines tomorrow. And it's a pretty good rule to live by.
It's about 4 weeks late.
Mr. Chair, I was just thinking about all those Christmas cards you sent me.
Senator Hall?
How about phone conversations? Are they private?
Senator Hall, it depends on if they're recorded. So say you leave me a voicemail message, and it's on a tape. It's recorded.
Okay. Then it's public.
It would be presumptively public.
Okay. But if you, Mr. Chair, if you taped a conversation that I was having with you, is that permissible?
Mr. Chair, remember, that's outside of my expertise. I think the law in Minnesota is only one person has to know your tape recording.
Okay.
So there's
right.
No law that would prohibit me from taping your phone calls. And in my hands, they'd be presumptively public.
Right.
Good question.
I have one for you, too.
Mr. Senator
Chair.
Goodwin. Go ahead.
Thank you. What about an investigation that is done by city police and there's probable cause found so that the investigation is turned over to the county attorney? Whether or not the county attorney decides to pursue that case, should that be public data by the city police?
Mr. Chair, Senator
yes.
Goodwin.
Ms. Beyer-Kerpensky.
There is protection for active criminal investigations.
Right.
And
yeah.
There is a process set out in statute of when that case becomes inactive. And one of the ways that a case becomes inactive and then presumptively public is if the prosecutor decides not to charge. So if the police send it over to the county attorney and the county attorney says, I'm not going to do any charges, that case now in the law enforcement's hands would be presumptively public.
Okay, and thank you,
yes,
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Goodwin.
What if, in the same case, the county attorney says, well, I'm not going to pursue this now, but I may pursue it at some time in the future?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure if we've had many of those instances. If they've said, I'm not charging right now, or I may, or I'm still pondering whether or not we will have elements of the data that will always be public, but there may still be some investigative data that will continue to be protected until that decision to charge or not charge, or the statute of limitations runs on that case. So it might really depend. So.
Ms. Beyer-Kerpensky, in the case of what Senator Goodwin brought up, can an individual who's the subject of a police investigation contact the police department and just point blank ask them, is there a investigation going regarding him?
Mr. Chair and members.
And what would they have to say?
Yes, and I was just going to say, Mr. Chair and members, that's what I would say. What the person needs to do is to write to the responsible authority for the police department and say, do you maintain confidential data about me? or any other kind of data. And the law enforcement's response would have to be, yes, we maintain data that's confidential about you, and here is the statute that classifies it. So it basically would tell you, yes, I've got an investigation going on about you. Because they have to say 1382.
And can they ask another question and say, what is it about?
Mr. Chair and members, no. The vehicle then, the private person would have to go to court to be able to try and gain access to any confidential data about them.
And that's in case someone's being investigated for a crime. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement doesn't have to reveal the extent or the data involved in it, but they may have to say, that, yes, we have some form of confidential record on you. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, members, when I talked about people being afraid after Watergate about secret files, that's why we didn't want to have just the existence of a record be so secret you couldn't even find out that it existed so that you could do something about it. So that's why we have that law requiring them to be able to answer, do they have data? Not what it's about, but do they have it? Right. Now, Senator Limmer also wanted me to highlight some of just the emerging and challenging issues in this field, and some of them are emerging and some of them are just perennial issues. One of them, and I think the Senator Limmer has mentioned this as well, how to charge for electronic copies of data, especially ones that have commercial value, both from the citizen and the government perspective. That is always one that generates lots of questions. From government, certainly they feel that they receive a lot of harassing and overly burdensome requests. Enforcement, you have passed civil and criminal and administrative penalties, but enforcement and compliance has always been an issue that people continue to raise. Training and education needs, you know, with declining budgets, how do you make sure the right people are trained? We have certainly in my office tried to use a lot of technology like webinars and webcasts and PowerPoints to get people information, but how do you do that cost effectively? Some other emerging issues. And I am not a good techie, but the cost to store data has really decreased. So we've got a lot more data that either gets automatically created and then just gets saved for a really long time. But the task of how do you redact that, how do you separate public and not public, hasn't been sped up at all. It really takes people's eyes. So we haven't found a good way to speed that part up. We just have a lot of data. Personal equipment being used by government employees to do their government work, that's a kind of a challenging and emerging new issue. Also, how to design databases to address on the front side the issue of having to pull apart public and not public data. Oftentimes, government is buying products off the shelf that aren't really designed to work with Minnesota's law, so that it requires a lot of retrofitting, and sometimes it's more expensive to design databases then, or at least that's what we hear from the IT community. And government contractors, maintaining government data, and just contracting with government in general has been a kind of an emerging issue for the data practices field. And I know that you will hear others from the other presenters as well. But if there are any other questions that you have for me, just remember, presumptions, everything is public. You're going to be weighing government need, accountability, and individual privacy rights as you make your decisions. And I hope that you will come to us as you have questions. We are unique for a state agency in that we will reach out to you when we see something in your bill that might need some tweaking. So just know that you can always call on us for that.
Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, I had a discussion just this morning with a citizen who wanted to review the budget of his county. And he went to the county public desk and asked for it. And they proceeded to tell him that it would cost him roughly $1,400. Mm-hmm. And he, because of that expense, he cannot afford to get a copy of the county budget. He was told that he could get for free a summary of a county budget, but anything in more detail he would have to pay for. Is that your understanding of Minnesota law and public documents like that?
Mr. Chair and members, one of the features that the legislature has passed is you can always inspect data for free. So if he goes to their office, he should be able to make a request to just inspect it. If he wants copies, he will then have to pay the actual cost for those copies if it's more than 100 pages. But you have also passed a limit. So if someone's making a public data request, and I assume the budget's probably 100 pages or less, that the max you can charge for that is 25 cents a page. So he can either inspect for free or pay for copies should he want them.
Do you know if he could get a copy of that on a CD disc at the place of origin for a lot less than that?
Mr. Chair and members, one of the things you can ask for a copy, however they maintain it. So if they have it both in paper or electronically, you can ask for it however way you want. And it may be the cost to have it, an electronic copy may be substantially less than making the paper copies.
And do you know, Mr. Byer-Krupinski, if things that are of the big nature, big public documents like a budget, would that be available to be printed online so that citizens could pull it up rather than go down and deal with someone at a city hall?
Mr. Chair and members, one of the things I didn't highlight this is some of the kind of emerging debates that they've had is whether or not you want to give more direction to government about pushing things out to websites. Right now, any of the public data that I have in my office or any government office, we can really make decisions about what we're going to push out and what we don't. And when we train people around data practices management, one of the features is the more you can have it out there, that will often reduce the number of requests that you have to handle, and that saves staff time. But certainly we have an advisory opinion from years ago that said if something was on a website, someone could still make an independent data request for it. But how much they put out on their website is really up to the government, at least as of this point.
Well, some of the discussion that we've had over recent years is whether or not the public, despite the fact that it may be available to them, the cost of it becomes prohibitively expensive, and then citizens can't really do the research on what their government does for or do them, and it bars any type of research. And it's been kind of an annual discussion of the cost of data, especially informational data, in this committee. And I think the committee has kind of erred on the good side. Its default position is that data and information that government is doing should be available, and it should not be the means to make a cash cow facility for the governing authority. They shouldn't be asking profit on it. It should be covering the expense of sharing that data with a citizen when they ask for it. I know that we've had that discussion probably 12 years in a row, and it's a good discussion to have. And I know not everyone gets into data practices, but it really has a lot of emphasis on how the citizens view government and how citizens participate with government. So it's vitally important to keep government as open as possible and make the means of gathering that information as cheap as possible for the citizens. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Goodwin.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Byer-Krupinski. It's a tough one.
Byer-Krupinski. Okay. You answered the question about, as far as legislators, whether or not the information we send out is public. But what about if a constituent's writing to us about a personal issue? Shouldn't that be considered private data? I mean, we should not be letting that information out, or...
Ms. Byer-Krupinski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, in the beginning, you are not subject to the Data Practices Act. So the legislature has its own rules of access. So I'm not sure if you actually have a specific one on how you treat your correspondence. So I think that you probably have the freedom to do whatever you want or to not share. But the legislature is not subject.
Wow.
So you would only be subject to data practices if you send something to government. So if you send something to me, I'm subject to the law. You're not.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Goodwin, I don't know how other legislators work it, but I want to make sure that citizens keep talking to me.
Right.
And if I am on record of sharing their letter or their name, something that's identifiable to them, chances are I'm not going to get too many letters. Now, that might give some of our senators some ideas. But nevertheless, I think you want to encourage as much information from our voters and constituents as possible. So I have basically a policy in my office that I don't share any correspondence with anyone unless I got the written permission from that individual. But you can do what
Mr. Chair, I feel the same way, but I think if it takes, I thought it was already protected data, but I think if it takes us putting it in the rules, then we should put it in the rules that it is private data from people.
Because right. They Ms. should Byers be able
to
break
it. Senator Goodwin, one thing I wanted to follow up with, as you get letters from your constituents who want you to help with either their local government or a state agency, so say someone mm-hmm. has issues with the Department of Human Services and they receive benefits from there, if you wanted to be able to communicate and get information from Human Services about that person, you're going to need that person's consent, or the government's going to say, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you about this because this is data that's not public. So you might have someone who contacts you and says, please help. You might actually need a consent form from them so that you can actually be a go-between between them and the government. So that's just something to be aware of.
I have another question. Occasionally I'll get a constituent who is reporting, let's say, a neighbor who's polluting his field or dumping something into a swamp and wants to have maybe the DNR to come and investigate it. Whenever I get that type of thing where there's a potential reporting of a criminal issue, I ask them permission. Can I move this to, can I send this to the DNR? Can I send this to the state auditor? You know, anything like that, I always seek the permission of the constituent and then move it on and advance it for them. Is there any rules that practice that I might be violating?
No, Mr. Chair. One thing that in your specific fact situation, the identity of someone who complains about real property. So if I complain about the barking dog at my neighbor's house or the polluting that they're doing, my identity at local law enforcement is protected. So if if DNR had that information about one neighbor complaining about another, that would be in a situation where their identity was not public. So again, you might need to have their consent before DNR would be willing to talk to you about that.
All right. One last question. If there's a government agency who's collecting data, this is government data, does, in order to collect a list or make a data form, does that format have to be approved by the legislature? Or can they independently create a list without the legislature giving authorization for it?
Mr. Chair and members, one of the things I highlighted is that data practices limits government to only collecting what they need to do their work. And often, an agency has a really large mission, and often you leave it up to them to figure out how much data they need to collect. There are some of those isolated ones, like the prevailing wage data situation or the permit to carry, where the legislature has said, we're so concerned about what government might overreach and collect that we're going to actually detail what they can collect. But that's pretty rare to see that, and often you just tell an agency, here's your mission, keep the public safe, and you figure out how you're going to best do that and how what data you need to collect to do that.
And one other question, under the significant federal laws that you've highlighted here.
Yes.
Now, my understanding was under HIPAA laws, the state is allowed to make more stringent data privacy provisions than what the federal government requires. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is correct.
And in Minnesota's case, we have done that in many different directions under HIPAA. But I'm unsure about the FERPA and the DPPA. Do we have that same authority to exceed federal data privacy guidelines?
Mr. Chair and members, as to FERPA, you have some ability to be more stringent, and it depends on whose rights you are enhancing, be it parents versus students, but it is more limited. It's not a clear preemption issue, and the same is true with Driver's Privacy Protection Act. You do have some flexibility, but it's not absolute as it is with HIPAA, where you can keep on going higher and higher that you want to.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our next witness is Don Gemberling. And if you've been around the legislature for any number of years, you know that Don Gemberling used to work with the Department of Administration regarding data practices issues. Now he's basking in retirement years and making the big private money and
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
I basked in my driveway this morning shoveling for the 47th time. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Gemberling. As the chairman has observed, I've been doing this for a long time. Basically, in some way or another, I've been dealing with the issues of government accountability and access to government information and data privacy and how technology affects human beings really since 1968. So I was always glad when my hair got white because that seemed to make more sense. So I'm testifying today basically in kind of two roles. I am, what you're seeing before you is institutional memory, okay? And I was thinking about that today because so much of what you do with data practices really requires institutional memory if you want to understand how you got to where you got here. And, of course, with the legislature being an elected body, some of that institutional memory goes out the door from time to time. So the other role I'm here playing is, since I retired, I got active with a group called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, whose objective basically is to try and maximize access to government information by the public. MnCoGI is composed of librarians, citizens, attorneys, media folks. We have we recently added an academic, and I'm their spokesperson, okay? I think they made me their spokesperson because I don't still work, so therefore I never can make my boss mad. So we do things in the acronym is Minnesota Coalition for Government Information, MnCoGI. We annually present the John Finnegan Freedom of Information Award. Some of you may remember John was the editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press for years and very active in freedom of information affairs. We do that on March 16th, which is Freedom of Information Day, which is also James Madison's birthday. The other activity, we do try and provide educational opportunities for people to learn about access to government information. We call those cogitations. Cogitations in the last year or so have included presentations by Jim Nobles about some of the things he was reporting to you on. A few weeks ago, I did a presentation to a number of citizens on how the Data Practices Act works. And thirdly, in recent years, we also show up here to comment on legislation. And I primarily do that. So if at any time you have questions, just feel free to ask. I know your time is limited, so I brought lots of handouts, okay? And kind of to serve as reference materials. I think my primary role is to kind of give you an overview of how you got here in general terms, not in specifics. So you have a very long history of looking at these issues. And by long, I mean back to 1973, which is when I got directly involved in working with the legislature. I think part of what explains how you got here is the quote that you have in your materials from Elliot Richardson, who at that time in 1973 was Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. It starts out with, "There's growing concern that automated personal data systems prevent a serious potential for harmful consequences." And some of us think that Elliot was kind of understated in his statement. He made this statement at the time he created a committee to advise health, education, and welfare on the growing use of computers in the federal government. Okay, the committee was a unique blend of citizens, academics, people who worked for the government. There was actually a young woman from Mendota Heights, Minnesota, who was on the committee. They met for a year or so, and they came out with a report. It had a really dull government name, the Report of the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Automated Data Systems. Its more popular title was Records, Rights, and Computers, right? Records, Rights of Citizens and Computers. That report had a major effect on how the federal government, on how state legislatures, and how even the private sector began to look at the collection and use of personal information, because the report contained what the committee called fair information practice principles. There were five of them, okay? And those five principles became embedded in Minnesota law when the Data Privacy Act was first enacted in Minnesota in 1974. And if you go through, you can actually find the principles played out in the statute. Let me give you an example. Ms. Beyer-Kopensky talked about when somebody comes and says, I want to go to goes to a law enforcement agency, and if they ask the question, are you investigating me, the agency doesn't have to answer that question. However, if they say, am I the subject of data maintained by this law enforcement agency, the Data Practices Act says the agency has to inform them that they're the subject of data maintained by the agency. Now, that carries out principle number one in the Fair Information Practice Principles. And that's the idea that the government should never keep systems of data on people that we don't even know exist, okay? And that was a big thing back in the 70s. Now, we know now that there are lots of systems of data that the federal government maintains on people that we don't know exist, but that's a compromise we've decided to make in the age of terrorism. So what you did in Minnesota, what the legislature did, was to take these principles and find some way to put them into law. And some of those ways of doing it are easy and some of them are kind of complicated. So, but as I said, they became the basis for lots of stuff. Now, part of what happened is after the first Data Privacy Act was passed in 1974, part of what happened is local government and state government said, this statute says we've got to do a lot of stuff. It also says we can get sued. And part of what it seems to talk about is privacy, and it doesn't tell us very much what privacy is really about. And so I'm going to be real careful here. And part of the carefulness meant that a certain amount of information that was once very available to the public, especially law enforcement information, suddenly became not available. Now, not surprisingly, media folks in Minnesota did not take kindly to that. Okay? So they also were very aware of the reality of Minnesota law at that time, which was we had a very old Official Records Act that didn't say much about public access to government information. What it primarily said is if the government had an official record of something, the public had a right to get access to that official record. And that had been interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court in a very narrow way. It had to be an official record, which essentially meant it had to be something the government had acted on. Okay, so media folks lobbied for a couple, 3 years for you to not just have a data privacy law, but also to have a Freedom of Information Act, okay, or some analog there too. And after a lot of discussion, and a lot of compromise, in 1979, the Minnesota legislature adopted the presumption that all government data in this state are public. Now, you've got a handout that's called Most Significant Policy Decisions in the first more than 30 years of the Data Practices Act. And I won't talk about all of these, but they are the ones that essentially still in many ways frame the debate and play a critical role on what government does or doesn't have to do because of the statute. So for example, if you look at number three, that's the presumption that all government data is public. If you look at number five, you'll see that it established the principle that if a citizen feels that the Data Practices Act is being violated, and that's a violation of any kind, the way, the most direct way for them to complain about that, although there are some new ways that people are trying, is you got to sue the government, okay? And that always goes by the name of private attorney general concept, with the idea that a citizen acts like the attorney general in requiring enforcement of laws. And that's part of the problem with the Data Practices Act. As Senator Limber mentioned, the person who is being told that they have to pay, what was it, $1,400 to get a copy of the budget, if the person doesn't like that, they can go get a commissioner's opinion that says that the county is wrong. But if the county says, well, we think the commissioner is wrong, then the citizen is still going to have to sue. Okay? Now, there is a new remedy you adopted last year, but with that new remedy, you go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and you start out by paying a filing fee of $1,000. Okay? Now, you may get it back if you win. Okay? So now, number seven, and there's a couple of these that have asterisks by them. Number seven says that the legislature is the only authority in this state that can decide that certain data are not public. Now, what that does, more than anything else, is it drives the size of the Data Practices Act. This is the Data Practices Act. Okay? Because you agreed that you would deal with these issues specifically and not use the system that everybody else uses, which is broad categories of exemptions, that drives the size of the Data Practices Act. Because as Ms. Lori Beyer-Kopensky observed, you're going to have people come this year. They're going to say, we're collecting more data about people. We're creating more data about businesses. We're doing all kinds of things with data. And we need to have it be not public. And you're the only people who can make that decision. Okay? Now, whether or not that's good or bad, you can talk about. But it really is what drives the size of the Data Practices Act. If you skip down to number 10, you'll also see that another driver for size of the act is another legislative decision that basically says when you have data that's not public, the legislature decides who has access to that data, how it can be used, that kind of thing. And so if, for example, you were to look at Section 13.46 of the Data Practices Act, which is a section that regulates welfare data, you would see that it says basically a very simple definition of what welfare data is, but then the next several pages of that section, and I mean several pages, are all authorizations to use and disseminate welfare data. Okay? So those are the things that drive the size of the act. Now, an important principle, number 12, and you talked about this, is the act tries to balance the idea that government information being made available to the public has a cost with the idea that not everybody can afford to pay that cost in the public. And that's why the act is provided, I think, from the beginning for free inspection of government information. The idea being, you know, if I can't afford to pay $1,400 for that budget, I'll take the time to go look at it because I can go look at it for free. So as I said, these, I think, are the most significant things you've done over the last 30-plus years that set up how things are currently. Now, one of the things you have is illustrative headlines and quotes. One of the things that I get aggravated about when I come to hearings is people will describe the issue of Data Practices Act, data practices as boring and cult-like. The cult thing always bothered me because as my hair got whiter and my beard got longer, I thought, geez, God, am I being viewed as some kind of cult figure? But the headlines are there essentially to say to you, this is about what's going on almost every day, okay? Because government is driven by lots of things, but part of how government is driven is by money. And how we keep track of what government is doing and how we get past press releases, how we get past laudatory things on websites is by actually going and looking at the data that the government is collecting, maintaining, using, et cetera, and seeing what's really going on behind the scenes. So I just wanted to give you some sense of that. And, you know, this stuff, the last few quotes I have here are from the last, month. So part of what I do in retirement, I get to read the paper in detail every day, and I keep track of this stuff. So as you can see, and we'll talk about this one a little bit more, but the University of Minnesota decided to have Google host its email. So if I'm a member of the public and I'm wondering what President Brunix is doing with something and I want to look at his emails, where do I get them? Do I still get them from the U? Or do I have to try and deal with Google? So, like I say, we'll talk about that some more. Some of you may have been aware that there's been a controversy, and I can't remember if it's Farmington or Rosemont, involving a school board member who has strong disagreements with other members on the board, and they decided at some point that board member had been violating the Data Practices Act by releasing data to the public, and they eventually ended up doing an investigation. And part of the recommendation was that his conduct be referred to the county attorney for criminal charges. And so back in December, the county attorney, according to the headline, took a pass on whether or not to charge that person with a criminal violation of the Data Practices Act. Now, frankly, I never understood why that went to the county attorney, because there is a criminal violation of the Data Practices Act, but it's a misdemeanor. And that's city attorney, not, as a matter of fact, the county attorney said the city attorney should probably look at it. So there was some reference to intelligence databases. Just last week, there was a request to the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office to look for some briefs about possible terrorist activities in the Twin Cities, and the current sheriff can't find some information that the former sheriff relied on to make some decisions. And over the weekend, there was a report on some problems in the State Department of Education where they released, I think it was 29 or 30 student transcripts to a member of the public, and student transcripts are clearly private data. So you know, it really is stuff that happens. It really are things that affect people's lives. It, like I say, some people think it's boring, but some of us think, you know, this is really what this is all about. So now, quickly, I want to go through some emerging issues and developments for you, because I think these are kind of some of the things, again, that's what it's called. These are things that are you're either going to deal with now or we're all going to deal with later, and they, frankly, are not easy issues in the scale of the universe. Part of what's happening with technology as it applies to government information is that increasingly government data is getting what I call ephemeral. It just doesn't seem to exist very long, okay? And Lori said she wasn't much of a techie. I'm a Luddite, okay? I'm a neo-Luddite, but I know how to do my VCR. Things like Facebook, Twitter, where all that fits in all of this, if the government starts using Facebook and Twitter and have government folks sending tweets, et cetera, where that fits in the scale of the Data Practices Act is, okay, we've said that all data in recorded form is government data, but how do I go get somebody's tweets? Okay? So one of the things I hear from people still in state government that I lunch with from time to time is that increasingly state agencies are being told to have very limited periods of time for retention of things like emails, like only keep your emails for 6 months. Well, there's a whole bunch of history and possible accountability that gets lost if that indeed is what's happening. Okay? Increasingly, we see that we're going to outsource government technology to the private sector. And that could be a very good thing. You know, there are places where the private sector may do a much better job of operating things. But, for example, if you take a big chunk of state government, the technology piece, and you send it to a private company, where does that fit in the scale of the Data Practices Act? Okay? Do you lose accountability? Do you make it harder for the public to get access to data? I talked about the U of M using Google Mail for their email, and that's both for students and for staff. State agencies now are contracting to use Microsoft for their email. And this is one of those places where I've talked to both reporters and a citizen who've been trying to get the state contract about that. State contracts are public. And they can't get the contract. And they've been asking for it for a couple, 3 months. And that just seems strange to me. Several years ago, based on a study that was done, you put a provision in the Data Practices Act that says when the government does outsource some of its functions, then the contract outsourcing the function has to have language that says the private entity understands and agrees to be subject to the Data Practices Act. That's Minnesota Statute Section 1305, Subdivision 11. I'm real curious if the Microsoft and Google lawyers signed off on that when you and Microsoft signed their contracts, okay? the prospect of Microsoft being subject to the Data Practices Act just really excites me. You know, Bill Gates was on Jon Stewart last night, so. The other thing that's happening with technology, and you're going to see more of that, is people go to the government and they say, I want to look, I'll keep using your example, Senator Limmer, I want to look at the budget for the county. And the county says, well, yeah, sure, you can look at the budget. It's on our website. Is that compliance? What if I say, I don't have a computer. I want to look at the budget. And I get met with, it's on our website. Okay? I don't think that's compliance. But when I ran into, somebody sent me an absentee ballot, and this probably illustrates how strange my mind works. I'm looking for the Tennyson warning on the absentee ballot. Tennyson warning is a notice that the government is required to give you when it collects private data from you. It's named after that guy right there, Bob Tennyson, who was in the state senate for a number of years. And when you do an absentee ballot, some of what's on the absentee ballot is private data, so a Tennyson warning is required.
Oh.
So I get to the magic lines that says, oh, by the way, if you want our privacy notice, you have to go on our website.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that's not compliance. But when I talked to the Secretary of State's office about it, they said, well, we think it is. Wait a minute. The whole idea behind the Tennyson warning is, when the government asks me for private data, I'm going to make a decision about whether or not I'm going to give it.
Yeah.
That's why the Tennyson warning contains what it contains, because it tells me things like whether or not I legally have to give it. And if I want to tell the government to buzz off, that's my right. But how do I do that when I'm filling out an absentee ballot form and now I have to go get on a computer to look to see what they're going to do with this information? So, as you can tell, that one got me kind of going. One of the things that's always been true about these discussions is that the media has come here and played a very active role, not only in protecting what some people often think of as their own self-interest, but often they're protecting the rights of the public to get access to data. Okay? And frankly, you know, most citizens don't come here and talk about these kinds of things for a whole variety of reasons, even though they care. Trust me, they care. What I saw last session, however, and in out in the real world of trying to get government agencies to comply, the media has always played a very active role in being the real enforcer of the Data Practices Act because they had the wherewithal to sue the government. Okay? Now, increasingly, as the media have encountered their own financial difficulties and media is changing in this world, less and less do they play that role. Okay? I've also found that they just seem to be less active, like they are with a lot of things, in educating the public about the Data Practices Act and government information issues. Okay, and some of that's illustrated by whether or not they come to hearings like this and write about it. Okay, I see language in stories like parents were allowed to see a survey about student behavior. Allowed is a word that, again, got me going because that was a survey containing all public data. The public had an absolute right to see that survey. This is a survey that's commonly known or colloquially known as the sex, drugs, and rock and roll survey that the Department of Education has been doing for years. Last session, as you were considering whether or not to add another addition to the enforcement arsenal, which is the ability of citizens to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings if they have a data practices dispute, I found myself fighting with media lobbyists about deals they were making with government organizations that essentially cut away at citizen rights. You know, the media is essentially in these disputes focused on one thing, getting access to data. There are all kinds of other possible disputes that affect citizens in the Data Practices Act. And so when we would talk, and I would say, what are you doing? The basic answer was, well, we're making deals with government organization lobbyists because they're going to kill our bill if we don't. And that is like, oh, now I got to fight with my old friends because I care very strongly about a citizen. And, you know, this started with a provision in the bill last session that said basically if parents had a dispute with a government agency about data about their kids in a school, they couldn't use the new remedy. Why would you do that? Especially, why would you do that in light of the fact, if you go and look at Commissioner of Administration opinions, you'll find that many disputes between citizens, real people, are with school districts about a whole variety of issues that don't have anything to do with access to government information. They have to do with other rights under the Data Practices Act. Compliance continues to be an ongoing problem. It just is. What I'm seeing is, again, the media isn't suing people very often. They don't have the money to do it. And so much of the possible violations of the Data Practices Act involve policies and procedures. For example, my grandson is 7 years old. His mother, who knows my proclivities, showed me a form she was supposed to fill out about my grandson, containing all kinds of detailed information about his developmental stuff, that kind of thing. No Tennyson warning at all. And it's like, oh, okay, so we're back to, do I go sue my grandson's school? Not likely, although who knows where I may go in years to come. A big problem that's been discussed for years is so much of this has to do with how well-trained government folks are. And government folks have been very honest with telling you that training is a problem because training costs money, okay? There was a study done of this back around 2000 or earlier through the Department of Administration. Clearly, training was an issue. And a whole training plan was developed and was actually put into statute, okay? And it was a training plan that when we first did it, it actually worked, okay? Because it really did focus on who needs to be trained about what. And oftentimes the people most need to be trained are the people like Senator Limmer's constituent who are at the front desk, okay? However, as my understanding is, the Department of Administration is now offering training on a fee basis. I can understand the budget pressures, but I also know that's not the way you get government folks to come to training, especially when government folks in most levels of government don't have the bucks. So if you're going to use training to get compliance, it's got to be free. It's got to have incentives. So there's lots of issues that, to me, as I read about them or I hear about them from others, seem to kind of reflect an attitude on the part of the government that says, we know what the real world is like these days. So if you don't like what we're doing, sue us. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's problematic. So, in summary, the most serious problem continues to be if you use a litigation model to get compliance, and that's what you're still doing, does it work? Now, when we did this cogitation a while back, two of the people who helped us do the cogitation were Senator Limmer and Representative Holberg. As some of you know, Representative Holberg has had a long-term interest in this. And they began talking about another model on how to deal with compliance. And that at some point is something you may want to talk about. Because you've had a model recommended to you at least three different times based on three different studies by three different groups of people. Probably the only thing they had in common was me. And there are other models as to how to do this that may be more effective. In closing, I gave you another piece similar to what Lori gave you about not just talking about the Data Practices Act when you deal with these things. You're talking about a whole bunch of other law that may affect what you're doing. There's lots of federal law out there, okay? And it's federal law that's often stated in terms of if you take our money, you got to do things. For example, a lot of the welfare data classifications are based on the Fed saying, as part of your plan to get our money, you have to provide confidentiality for welfare recipients. Okay. There's also, however, some case law. We don't have a lot of case law because of the model that we use, but some of the case law is very significant. You may at some point hear the expression Keiser data. You'll never find that in the Data Practices Act. It's in a case. Senator Ingebretson, you may have known, I have to get my names right.
Remember, I don't go very far back now.
Okay. You may have known a sheriff named Senator Sheriff Spickard. Yeah. There's a case, a Court of Appeals case called, Keyser versus Spickard. A guy sued Sheriff Spickard for violating his rights under the Data Practices Act. The violation consisted of something that the sheriff said to a number of people. But the question was whether or not that was government data within the meaning of the Data Practices Act. And the Court of Appeals wrote a really good opinion that said, no, it wasn't. Because the sheriff did not say what he said based on something that was recorded. He said it based on what he knew of this particular individual. Now, that opinion, by the way, was written by Judge Peterson, who used to be a charter member of the Senate Data Practices Subcommittee. And if you see Senator or Judge Peterson writing opinions about data practices, they're usually pretty knowledgeable. If at any time I can be of help to you with institutional memory, whatever, or the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information can be of help to you, feel free to ask. Thank you. Question.
You, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gamberling, I have to say that, you know, I think that if Minnesota has more open government than other states, it's because of all the hard work you've done over the past 40 years, or nearly 40 years, over 40 years, in fact. And we owe a lot of our good laws to the work that you've done. So I really appreciate that. And sorry to hear you retired. I thought you were going to be in the job forever, and I would have liked that very much. Because I'm too very concerned about openness and transparency in government. And I appreciate the fact that you talked about the state contracts, because I know that senators often have trouble getting information from agencies still. And there's really nothing we can do about it either if they don't give us the agencies. We can, or the information, we can always threaten their budgets or whatever, but that's about the only tool we have. So I think in the state contract information is very important. The way they keep data on state contracts is very important to business in the state as well as to government. So, and you talked about the potential of having other forms of compliance besides litigation. And I'm wondering if you've heard of anybody that's introducing any legislation to make some changes to that. Because if we have that much trouble getting information, I'm sure the public, and I know for sure the public does have trouble getting information out of government.
Mr. Gamberling.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, I don't know of anybody who's got anything drafted. So
I'd be interested.
I've always got something drafted, but I'm not a senator.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Mr. Goodwin. Gamberling, I'm very glad you could speak very openly and freely. Not that it stopped you being in your job before, but now you could really really come forward with your ideas and not have to worry about what the administration thinks.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, Mr. Gamberling. One of the reasons, frankly, I'm glad to be retired is in the last 10, 12 years I did my job, which spanned three different administrations, I want to point out. It got harder and harder to do that.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gamberling, Senator Goodwin touched on the question that I had, and you had indicated that the most significant compliance problem that we have is the litigation model. You told us that there was other models out there, so you kind of tantalized us and then you dropped it. You didn't tell us what the other models were. Could you briefly comment on that?
Mr. Gamberling.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, yeah, the problem with the other models, particularly in the session such as this one with the challenges you face, is the other models cost money. That's just the way they are. The models tend to, and some people have philosophical disagreements with us, the other models tend to say, we're going to make this an important function of government, bring it inside the government, do it in such a way that it resists political tampering, that kind of thing, and give it a much more influential role. I'll give you an example. The province of Ontario, our neighbor to the north, has an office called the Office of the Freedom of Information and Privacy Commissioner. That office exists, among other things, to make sure that the Ontario Freedom of Information and Privacy laws are enforced. One of the things I always appreciated about that office is they also do a tremendous amount of research so that in many ways they're ahead of the game as opposed to always kind of the technology thing being something that they lose sight of. And that kind of model in various forms is the most common model that's used around the world. We're one of the few developed countries that does not use that model.
All right. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, it sounds like you are suggesting that it'd be a good idea to set up a separate agency or a separate department or some area within the government to comply with the data product. What happens then, Mr. Gimberling, when there's a disagreement between, say, a citizen and this new agency? What would the model be then to resolve that dispute?
Mr. Gimberling.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, in my experience, usually there have not been disagreements. You know, I've spent a lot of time hanging around with these people from Canada. Not, by the way, because I traveled up there on my huge expense account, but I can't remember, frankly, within their laws if they have a way of doing that. They do get into disagreements with citizens, clearly. One of the opinions of the Ontario office that we actually used one time in a Department of Administration opinion involved a person who was using the Ontario Freedom of Information Act to harass government agencies. And that citizen took strong exception to what the commissioner in Ontario did and sued her, and the courts threw it out. I think that probably is the ultimate answer, that if you disagree with what they do, you can sue them. So, right. But it rarely happens. So.
Well, seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Gimberling, for gracing us with your knowledge and history. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and like I say, feel free to call on me.
So. I heard sometimes you go by the name of Santa on occasion when you're wearing red sweaters like that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you and I have known each other for a long time, and you need to be real careful, because guess what my daughter gave me for Christmas?
Oh, no.
What?
Slave.
She gave me a Santa suit.
Way too big, right?
And by the way, I am not Bill Holm. Bill Holm is dead. Okay? And I'm definitely not Jerry Garcia, because he's dead too. Thank you.
We might have to make a special data privacy provision on that Santa thing.
Yeah.
Well, let's put it out in the public.
The next on the list is Richard Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister is a citizen lobbyist. He makes data privacy a kind of a specialty of his. And he's often here giving us testimony. Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the committee.
Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for giving me the honor. And decades plus, I can't remember right where I've been invited to engage a committee.
You're always welcome.
I'm on the other side of the bill or something or whatever. When I look around, particularly with the new people, I've enclosed in a packet and some information about me. I won the John Finnegan Award a couple of years ago, and NPR did a piece about me and give you a little bit of background from where I come from. When I look around the committee, I see lots of faces that I do know because I've engaged at least with those people that have been around a while. Even the chief, well, when he was in chief, I dealt with him on privacy issues, on public issues, in many different ways, and a lot of them involve citizens. And that's what I'm going to try and do in the 5 to 8 minutes that I have, is to talk to you about the citizen's perspective. And that's where I've always come from. One of the things that I want to try and leave you with, it's my goal, is to get you engaged as when the issues come into play into your purview in the next several months. One is to get you to become involved and also to invest time. Because no matter what you do in other things, and those are important, this is one that affects all the people who you represent, all your constituents. and some of the issues that that come into play. And so from my perspective, I just wanted to encourage you, because you've got to remember you deal with privacy and also the right to know, and you have to balance. Now, one of the things that I want to clearly state to you why it's important for you to take the time is that when Mr. Gemberling talked about these broad exceptions, it's not the citizens who are making the decisions. It's not elected officials, in a way. It is judges who are elected, but it's the judges who will interpret these broad exceptions. And I'll give you three, which a lot of states have done. It is in the public interest to deny you the public data, or the data, which would be in public in this state. It's an invasion of privacy to give that to you. We cannot give that to you because it will compromise the deliberative process, which is basically all the memos and all the records that help make a report, because you want to see how you got from A to Z. In a great many of those states, as Senator Goodwin said, Mr. Chair, a lot of that stuff is not public because you were engaged, either you or your past elected officials, you've been involved, and you invested time to do that balance so that I as a citizen and the folks who you represent, whether they come together as a group or whatever, to be able to get that kind of stuff that we've not been able to get, but also to protect their privacy. So I wanted to stress the importance, because you are doing those kinds of segregations of things. Now, who is someone that I engage with that ever since I was a young kid living in a housing project in McDonough here in St. Paul has been government? Government collects information on us consistently. I was a project kid. My dad was a disabled vet. I know what government can do for you and what it can do against you. So it's been in those kinds of veins that where I've been at this for decades, it's important to enunciate the principles of accountability, transparency, openness, where I engage a lot in, but also to protect the privacy of all the kinds of information that have been gathered on us. Now, to emphasize again, the Data Practices Act is routinely used by citizens. It's become a fact of life, in general that government does not like. Those government associations and folks will be coming in with their proposals this year, like they do every year. And citizens will come and say, hey, this has an impact on our right to know what's happening with our government. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, there's still, what, 4 more months yet? And only 200 bills. And I think every year you at least have 2,500 or at least 2,000 bills for each body. So that's a little bit down the pike. One of the other things that I would like to just talk about is some of the comments that were made and to add for more information. A model. State of New York, State of Connecticut, and other groups have like a commission kind of form. New York has been there for decades, same along with Connecticut. There was also the description about when Chairperson Limmer talked about the citizen that's knocking on the door at Hennepin County or whatever. I was thinking it might be Hennepin County because Maple Grove. But the bottom line is that government has a responsibility, and you have to take a look at the law, to be stored in such a way that is readily accessible. One of the things that I test a lot, and as some of you may know, there have been reference to a blog. Until this summer, I never had a computer. I wasn't connected to the internet or any of that stuff, and there was a little incident that happened, and I've been going full forward ever since, full throttle on that. And one of the things I was told when in the city of St. Paul when I wanted to take a look at something, well, it's on the internet. Well, I'm not connected. Well, I'm not going to give it to you, but you can go to the library, where then I have to, you know, wait in line for 15, 20 minutes. The issue is very clear. It should have been readily accessible either in paper form or whatever. That's one of the things that you have all diligently, you and your past folks, have done to make sure. Now, one of the things that I think that are starting to emerge are issues of how easily accessible information is to where, when that budget, as an example, or a report or whatever, they'll say, well, we're going to have to charge you for that or whatever. Even though it's an electronic form, it's just a buzz. Makes it easy. Recently, with the Met Council, I asked for some information. They were going to charge me for doing the scanning. I said, well, it's part of the electronic record. It's already there, and they didn't charge me. But it was like $4 or $5. So I think we have to take a look at those kinds of things, but that's an aspect of training. The other thing is records management. Historically, there was a statute where the Department of Admin was the central player of records management for the state. You know, taught, did some standards. You go to any agency now, and they're all over records management. And everyone has their own little standards, at least with state government. So I think that's because if you don't have records management, you don't know what, where, when. Thirdly, and one of the things is all these databases. Hey, we don't need consent anymore. Again, that's one of the things, again, the Data Practices Act. If there's going to be information shared from one entity to another entity for an individual, private data, basically need consent. But it's too costly to do get consent anymore. So let's just get a law, again, based on the premise that you has been here, let's just share the data, but the individual doesn't know anything about. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can't stress the importance that this is to the citizenry and the people of Minnesota. So those three things of engagement, involvement, and investment will pay off long run for you and in long run for the people who you represent. Now, as any of your elder colleagues will tell you, I've been very helpful. I can be a pain in the keister, but I'll give you the pro and I'll give you the con. And I have a point of view. But when I sit at least with the three people that, well, you know, I remember Senator Scheid on Minnesota driver's license almost 25 years ago, maybe 20 to 25 years ago. Chairperson Limmer, his first big bill out of the thing in 89 about doing away with the secrecy of the pardons. Senator Latz, when he was Representative Latz, there was some information about the University of Minnesota students and how they collect information and all that. And one of my favorites is Senator Marty, I think in 87, is first doing something on smoking in the schools. It was a good thing, you know, but just how that information was shared, I had a different perspective, and some of you. And now with Mr. Ingebrigtsen at 3 o'clock, his next committee, he has a bill, Senate File 42, that will be dealing with environmental impact statements. So I'm just leaving you with a quote. One of the strengths of a democracy is that it trusted citizens to make intelligent choices about how they should live and be governed. But knowledge is necessary in order to make such choices, and openness in government helps to achieve that end. Information is the currency of the democracy in which I believe in, and I believe that all of you believe in, or else you would not have tried to be elected and then to achieve that goal that you so wanted. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, folks, you know how to get a hold of me. I have no problem letting you know or whatever, but I'm willing to help, and thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any brief questions for Mr. Neumeister? You've covered just about everything, Mr. Neumeister. Thank you. One last guest today is Mark Anfinson from the Newspaper Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anfinson, a longtime attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association and attorney for many other components of the state's news media over the years. Time flies when you're having fun, and I acknowledge I'm at the very end of your agenda. I really am here today, and you won't hear this from me again in any session, last and least in terms of your witnesses. So I can be brief, can I not? And I will be. A few quick points. I have worked with the Data Practices Act because the news media of the state are primary consumers of the Data Practices Act. Information about government is a principal part of news coverage, and it should be. And so I have sat here and participated in most changes and revisions to the Data Practices Act over a long period of time. And through that, have come to appreciate its strengths and its weaknesses, and it has many of both. I'll just give you a few bullet points and conclude. First of all, the state's news media strongly support the current structure of the Data Practices Act, by which I mean no classification of government records occurs without legislative approval, case by case by case. And I contrast that with the disaster known as the Federal Freedom of Information Act, a misnomer if ever there was one, because that is a complete failure. It is nothing. Let me say it this way. The FOIA is barely more than a marketing tool for federal officials anymore. It doesn't really function well to provide access to individuals and the media. Second bullet point, I want to emphasize the value and importance of legislative expertise. The law has become complex, and the value of having defined committees through which pretty much all data practices legislation flows, and so that it can be scrutinized by both the members of the committees, such as this one, and the staff, such as Kathy Pontius, who has much valuable experience in the law, is extremely important. And I could give you myriad examples of the commotion that occurs when data practices classifications are not carefully drafted. I will argue a case on March 1st at the Minnesota Supreme Court involving the question of whether or not the public has access to unopened absentee ballots cast in Minnesota elections that were rejected and never opened. And it's a perfect illustration of how slight sloppiness with the language of a classification can lead to what Mr. Gemberling correctly described as the misfortune of litigation. Our main concern from the perspective of the news media with the current Data Practices Act is its functionality, if I can say it that way. There's something close to a creeping paralysis in government with respect to the Act that is a product mainly of its perceived complexity and its actual complexity. And they're two different things, but they're related. It's become, because of this complexity, perceived and actual, a heavy weight on government. It's quite remarkable to me, having watched most of this evolution, how much money is spent by government to try and comply with this law imperfectly. It is also now often failing requesters, the public, the media, individual subjects of data, because it's so difficult to often navigate or understand or procure compliance that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. If that leads to litigation, that is a failure of the law. And so I think if there is a focal point for the legislature, and it is a humble opinion, because I don't presume to be the oracle. He's sitting behind me over my shoulder. I don't presume to tell you what to do, but if someone was to ask me, where can most of the improvement come or where should it come? I would talk about the functionality. How can we improve the actual working of the law? I have some ideas about that. I will not burden you with them today because we have little time. But I think that is where this can be made a better law. It's a good law now. I don't want that to be overlooked. It's an important and valuable law for government, for citizens, for the subjects of private data. I think it can be made better, and I look forward to participating in that process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. Any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Goodwin.
It sounds like everybody's got, I mean, not everybody, but the last two anyway, have some good ideas about what we need to do, and it would be wonderful if you would share those with us sometime, because, you know, I really think it's an important issue.
I appreciate
it. I'd like
that.
To hear your opinion, those people that are working with it all the time.
I will be happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, you can tell that the Data Privacy Act is probably, or the laws that we have on data privacy, is kind of a subtle set of laws that we don't always think of from day to day, but they're vitally important to the function of citizens being involved with their government and telling us what to do. And hopefully we have open ears for that. And at the same time, we aren't creating a special subdivision in committee form to handle it. We don't have the time and the hours to do it this year. So we'll all get a little introduction to data privacy, and it's probably something that we should do because of the vital nature of this area of law. As for the county that I made reference to early on, it's not Hennepin County. I know that the commissioners would be pounding on my door in the next few hours if I didn't say that, but it's the county just to the west of us. And at that, having no other business, and I got to get out of here, the committee is adjourned.